is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and it's the first week of 2022, which in our current timeline equals roughly 1,000 years. That said, many of us are kind of slowly settling into the routine of the new year. We're making sure we write 22 rather than 21 in the dateline. But even as we're making those transitions, politics is still big work, and it never stops. So take a listen.
Party leaders butted heads over the future of the filibuster in the evenly divided U.S. Senate. Democratic Majority Leader Chuck Schumer vowed again to schedule a vote on a rules change.
We're going to see, as you all have been hearing, continued rise in cases.
Only a small number of perpetrators were arrested in the tumult of January 6th itself. Every day since, we have worked to identify, investigate, and apprehend defendants from across the country.
Devin Nunes is no longer a member of the U.S. Congress representing California.
You called this a terror attack. It's a lie. You told that lie on purpose, and I'm wondering why you did.
The way I phrased things yesterday, it was sloppy, and it was frankly dumb. And
I don't buy that. Whoa, I don't buy that.
The Republican Party has to make a choice. We can either be loyal to our Constitution or loyal to Donald Trump, but we cannot be both.
Democrats are facing both the substantive question of whether they can move a critical policy agenda and the structural challenge of whether they can repair the filibuster. And of course, at the root of everything this week was an even more foundational question of whether our system of democratic self-governance can survive in a nation so divided. A question prompted by the one-year anniversary of the Capitol riots. Although some of those reflections were, well, maybe a bit off-key.
We're privileged to have a contribution from one of the great creative talents of our time, Lin-Manuel Miranda. May his beautiful words be an inspiration to us.
Someday, someday, yeah, you'll blow us all away.
Oh boy, let's get to the roundtable. Sahil Kapoor is a senior national reporter at NBC News. Welcome, Sahil.
Great to be with you.
And Maya King is a national politics reporter at Politico. It's always great to have you, Maya.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
All right. So let's start in, I think, what was the lead story and maybe the main thing churning our stomachs much of the week, which was reflecting on and marking January 6th. Sahil, let me start with you. As you look at how Republicans were talking about and marking this somber anniversary on Thursday, what kind of politics did you see playing out?
We saw kind of two different worlds playing out on Capitol Hill, where I was through most of the day on January 6th. The only two Republicans that I saw were named Cheney, Liz Cheney and her father, Dick Cheney. They came to commemorate the events of January 6th. But most Republicans were absent. And the Senate side, many of them were at the funeral of the late Georgia Senator Johnny Isaacson. That includes the minority leader, Mitch McConnell, who was very critical of the events of January 6th, called it a failed insurrection on that night by an unhinged crowd that tried to disrupt American democracy and failed. But in the weeks and months since then, he has gone quiet about that day. He talks less about it today. He is more reluctant to criticize former President Trump, as he did shortly after that, holding him personally and morally responsible. So the politics, the needle has shifted dramatically in terms of the politics, where many Republicans who were horrified on that day have seen that the former president has fed conspiracy theories and in many cases lies to their base about a stolen election. Many voters believe those lies. And as a result, lawmakers on the Republican side have gone reluctant to fully embrace the reality of the 2020 election, which is that it was fair, it was legitimate, Joe Biden won. On the Democratic side, there is real dread that January 6th is not the end, that it was just the beginning of what could be a continued attempt, another attempt down the road to try to steal an election, Melissa.
All right. So Maya, you know, clearly at least one way to counter a narrative is to offer a different narrative. So let me just ask this. How far along is the January 6th Commission in not only prosecuting insurrectionists, but really sort of developing a clear narrative that provides a different storyline for the American people?
Yeah, you know, I think what the commission is doing now essentially is trying to, as you said, create a more complete picture of exactly what happened that day. And what you're seeing is now them not only trying to create more or bring out more details of the day, but also more of the power players and more of the folks who were involved in not only planning the events, but also encouraging the president to stand down. I think that's really what's going to play a large role, especially in the minds of voters and also in Democrats crafting messaging around January 6th, hoping that that's something that will stick heading into the November election. I think one thing that I've heard from a number of people, particularly on the ground, is that January 6th as an anniversary this year, something that has wide-ranging impacts, particularly though only in Washington. And I think now what you see the commission doing is, one, racing against the clock, being able to get all of this work done to actually paint a full picture of what happened that day ahead of the November elections. But again, also be able to name names and have a clear picture to paint to bring to voters before that ominous sort of election deadline.
Okay, you have brought us, Maya, to where we're sitting at this moment. First week of January 2022 means, yes, ding, 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 we are in a midterm year, which means everything, right? Every calculation, maybe this is always true, particularly for members of the House, but every calculation is about November, is about how it's going to play and what it's going to mean. So let me just kind of walk through some of that here. Sahil, let me just start with you about the economy and the question, you know, of whether or not the economy, the various different kinds of measures we have going on. Is this an economy likely to play well for Democrats come November? Or are we facing some challenges as a nation that will really, you know, portend poorly for them at the polls?
If the economy looks like it does today and the political landscape looks like it does today, Democrats are in big, big trouble, likely to lose control of the House of Representatives and probably also the Senate. But we don't know what the political landscape is going to look like. And of course, the economy has a lot to do with it. One of the big concerns over the last 5 or 6 months or so has been the issue of inflation. That is a real pocketbook concern for many Americans. The White House had initially downplayed it as transitory and has since recognized that is not the case, that this is certainly real. Much of it has to do with disrupted supply chains, but it is also an issue that could change dramatically between now and the midterm elections. And as a result, people could be feeling differently about it. Gas prices was an issue, you know, that reared its head several months ago when they went up pretty dramatically. It is certainly plausible that they'll come down again by the midterm elections. And of course, COVID has everything to do with the economy as well, because the Delta variant and now the Omicron variant have created economic disruptions to people's jobs, to schools, which obviously affect parents in innumerable ways. So all of those things have created a frustration with the state of the economy, even though by some metrics, it is booming. Jobs are being added, opportunities are there. The big question is what things look like in the months of August, September, October, when people fully make up their minds about the economy. If it improves, then Democrats have a much better shot. And they do, I should say, have a better shot at holding the Senate than they do the House. The House tends to be more subject to the whims of, political moments and political backlashes to the president in power. But the Senate's a bit more of a complicated story.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, just as a reminder, not that everyone listening to this show doesn't already know, but right, partly that's because everybody in the House is up for either election or re-election, whereas only one third of the Senate, right, in each of these every 2 years. And so, Maya, let me come to Sahil's point, though, that you can't talk economy without talking COVID-19 and the continuing pandemic crisis. But I want to turn it just a little bit. And on the one hand, there are the realities of the pandemic, the realities of illness, death, the impact that has on public policy and the economy. But there's also simply a perception about whether or not the Biden administration is managing and handling this well. So Maya, I'm asking sort of where, when you're looking at the Biden approval numbers right now around COVID-19, what is your crystal ball telling you about the fall?
Well, I think I wish I had a crystal ball because
yeah, I mean, you were like, wait, I have a crystal ball? Tell you, where is this?
Because it's the perception of this administration's handling of the of COVID-19, right? I mean, the president was elected in large part because of his messaging on COVID, saying that he would be the president who would get the country out of COVID. And now, a year later, that isn't quite the case. And so this is not only how voters are perceiving this administration, but I think it's how this administration is messaging to its voters and the calm or even chaos that it is putting forth to constituents. One thing that I believe, you know, would overshadow this, hopefully we're out of COVID by November, because I think that could be another issue for this administration and for Democrats writ large, is testing shortages and how that also factors in to the supply chain. Like, there's a number of different things. I think that COVID, to Sahil's point, kind of is a bigger part of a lot of the other issues taking place in the country right now. And so as Biden and his allies aim to message and project calm, to say that they have these crises under control, I think as long as COVID is raging, it's a lot harder for voters to understand that and to believe that. And that also plays, you know, has a direct role in voter enthusiasm, which is something that they're absolutely going to need heading into November.
All right. Sorry. So, Hill, let me come to you on this point. And my I think I'll probably circle back around to you as well on this one, which is, you know, I think we have a maybe all of us who are sort of, you know, optimists in the American project would like to believe that at their core, voters show up and make a choice based on policy, based on decisions that have been made in their legislatures, both at the state and national level, that impact their lives. Now, you know, research does seem to show us that may not exactly be what happens, right, in those voting booths. But presumably, either passing or failing to pass Build Back Better and the public policies associated with it could have an impact come fall. So, Sahil, let me start with you. Is there any possibility that Build Back Better is going to emerge again, at least in some form, and make a difference come November?
Well, not as it passed the House of Representatives. That version is not coming back. But there is an opening for Senate Democrats to pass a different version. And I think the you know, their path is pretty clear to me based on multiple conversations I've had with Senator Joe Manchin, who is the holdout among the 50 Democrats. They have 49 other votes and they need his. And the path to winning his vote seems fairly clear to me. It's to do fewer programs, to do them well, to make them last over a 10-year period and make sure they're funded. Manchin's problem with the House bill is that it includes a lot of programs, many, many programs, some of which are set to expire in a year or two or three, but are paid for over, you know, with taxes and revenues and savings that last for a decade. Manchin views that as gimmicky. His attitude is that every program is likely going to be extended anyway, and as a result, it needs to be paid for over the long haul. So what will it require? It means making painful sacrifices. You know, do they keep the enhanced child tax credit, or do they keep universal pre-K? Do they keep the climate change provisions, or maybe make some changes or limits to the healthcare subsidies? This is a huge, huge piece of President Biden's domestic agenda. This is his one chance to create, you know, new programs that will outlast him far down the road, which is something that, of course, you know, his predecessor, his Democratic predecessor, Barack Obama, did with the Affordable Care Act. This is something that he has aspired to. And the Build Back Better Act is a smorgasbord of policies that Democrats have been poll testing and writing for many years. They know these are popular. This bill has remained popular. That's such an irony about this, Melissa. This bill has remained popular even as the president's rating has fallen quite a bit. The country likes what's in this bill, the new safety net programs, the taxes on the wealthy and corporations, the prescription drug savings. The White House faces a challenging task of putting it back together, but they have a path to doing it.
So Maya, let me ask if there's a way that legislators might be thinking about, lawmakers might be thinking about threading that needle. They're the ones, after all, that will be on the ballot in the midterms. Where do you see maybe some of these painful choice cuts happening? Where are they going to make the push to pass the policies that will have a real impact, not only in the country, but on their own reelection chances?
You know, I'm thinking less about where they might make these cuts in terms of how they might figure out, you know, different policies that could sort of be put on the chopping block, though I know that's a huge part of this. I think, though, at the same time, what they're really looking at and what legislators are looking at is how voters are going to respond to this and what pressure they need to apply to their colleagues accordingly. My colleagues out on Friday with this really interesting story about how now, you know, related more to filibuster reform, you see folks like Bill Clinton and even Oprah Winfrey trying to pressure Joe Manchin to reform the filibuster. And so the question in my mind now is, is this the route that other Democrats are going to take to be able to push this legislation through? Focusing on what voters want, obviously the big thing here is the popularity of this legislation. I don't think, you know, that can be discounted. My question now is, what routes are Democrats willing to take to push this through and to be able to apply pressure to their colleagues to make this happen? I think the thing that's overshadowing all of this that we're talking about this morning, of course, are the midterm elections in November. And so the next 10 to 11 months are going to go by extremely fast. And with all of these issues sort of bearing down on voters and front of mind, especially in the minds of these more vulnerable Democrats, we're going to have to see the party Democrats get a little bit more creative in how they plan to realistically make their agenda viable and passable in this short period of time.
Maya, I need an all stop from you for 1 second because I need to back up just to one point. If Oprah Winfrey is able to convince Joe Manchin to get on board with filibuster reform, does she become immediately president, emperor? Like, what happens if she's able to do that?
I think she's still Oprah. She's able to do it, quite frankly. But it would be just another weird quirk in this whole political machine. Now, I have very little knowledge of what role she's played here. But my colleague Burgess Everett, who is a just masterful Senate reporter, was able to confirm that detail, that she's also alongside Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and several other Democratic heavyweights on the phone with Joe Manchin to try to break him down on this, which goes to show you just how important voting rights and voting rights legislation is to Democrats, not just for the party, but for small D democracy as well.
Yeah, Sahil, let me come to you on that. I mean, I may never get over the Oprah thing in my head, but Sahil, I want to talk to you about voting rights and this pivot. I mean, part of what's happened around Build Back Better here is there's been a sort of our top priority pivot, you know, is the language out of the Democratic Party. Is this pivot one that actually might work for them, right? In other words, is it possible that they can get the structural change in the Senate necessary in order to move a meaningful package of voting rights reform through the U.S. House and then also through the Senate?
There are two things to keep in mind about this. There are two major pieces of legislation that have a path to getting a majority in the Senate and can likely also pass the House in a very similar form. It's called the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. They have the support of all 50 Democratic senators, including Joe Manchin. So if they can do that, if they can pass those bills, it would be a dramatic shift in voting rights across, you know, the national level. It would create a voting access guarantee, such as universal access to mail-in voting, early voting. It would make Election Day a federal holiday. It would insulate state officials from undue partisan influence. And of course, the John Lewis bill would would raise the bar for states with a rolling history over 25 years of racial discrimination. They'd have to pre-clear changes to voting laws with the federal government. So if Democrats can do that, it would be a transformative shift. But of course, as you mentioned, they need to change the filibuster in order to do that. Currently, the Senate requires 60 votes to cut off debate to call an up or down vote on a bill. And that's where this entire conversation is right now. And it's going to be enormously challenging to convince Senator Joe Manchin to make a change to the filibuster using a partisan vote that would enable passage of voting rights legislation. He has told me and a few other reporters over the last few days that he is open to specific changes in the filibuster, such as requiring a talking filibuster. The minority has to hold the floor and speak. He doesn't see the need to have this, you know, 60 vote threshold on the front end just to debate a bill, but he's reluctant to cut it off on the back end. There's also Senator Kyrsten Sinema, who has an objection to making changes to the 60-vote rule. She's also going to be a problem for Democrats who I don't think she's getting enough attention. People shouldn't assume she will be on board, even if Manchin is. Her view is that eliminating or making stark changes to the filibuster could boomerang against Democrats in a few years if Republicans take control. For instance, if there's a carve out for election related legislation, then she worries that Republicans will use it to enact nationwide voter ID or something like that. So those two are the big puzzle pieces for Democrats to find some way around that 60 vote hurdle. But of course, the reason Democrats aren't giving up, the reason you see Oprah Winfrey and Bill Clinton and Barack Obama and all these figures getting in, is that Democrats genuinely believe that there is an existential threat to democracy at play, that the American way of life is under siege as a result of the big lie and all these election conspiracy theories. And that's why they aren't willing to throw in the towel on this just yet.
So we have Democrats who are bleeding on the Democratic side, choosing not to seek re-election. And then we have this news about Devin Nunes and his new role as CEO of Trump's new media company. Help me to understand, in this context of high stakes, both how Democrats and Republicans are thinking a bit about the best ways to make impact.
Sure. I think with Nunes's case, the way that I've interpreted it is sort of this consolidation of power around the former president. Donald Trump still is very much the standard bearer, the leader of the Republican Party, and still has a number of folks who would want to be in that orbit, depending on what he does. One, what influence he wields over 2022 and what he does, whether he ultimately runs in 2024. I imagine Nunes thought that he would be very well positioned, I guess, to take advantage of some of that. But at the same time, I think he's a bit of an outlier in terms of the folks who have announced their retirement or stepped down from their roles in the House. The profile of a legislator who has announced their retirement, I think you see a lot of folks, a lot of moderates, a lot of people who are used to having more collegial relationships with folks across the aisle, who have just kind of looked around and observed the political climate, not only in the country, but particularly in Congress, and kind of thrown their hands up to say, there are other things I can do here to help, but I'm not sure if this is really where I want to be anymore. And I think that it's very telling. It reveals something about where we are as a country, and just how polarized our politics have become, and the fact that it's leaked up to the higher levers of power here is one sign of things. I think that a number, particularly of the folks who have decided to retire, are saying that they'd like to see change. And I think it'll be incumbent upon, one, the folks who fill those roles and fill those seats, and two, the outcome of this next election, to see just whether or not this is something that is here to stay, if this environment is the new norm for American politics and especially the folks on the Hill.
Maya King is a national politics reporter at Politico, and Sahil Kapoor is a senior national political reporter at NBC News. Thank you both for joining us.
Great to join you.
Thank you.
Want to be a part of our show? Call us at 877-869-8253. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE. Give us your thoughts on any of our stories. And you can even send us a voice recording or memo to takeawaycallers@gmail.com.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. The January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol 1 year ago was shocking, but not unprecedented. Indeed, progress and backlash, punctuated by political violence, has characterized critical moments in American history. Preserving Democracy, Pursuing a More Perfect Union is a new documentary from PBS, and it chronicles this long history, starting with the Revolutionary War and bringing viewers right up to the 2021 Capitol riot.
If we believe that democracy is real, then democracy should always be on the chopping block, not in terms of its complete invalidation, but its scrutiny, its questioning, and tests of its own durability and resilience for the world we live in.
For more on the documentary, I spoke with Dana Roberson, executive producer of Preserving Democracy, and with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Dr. Marcia Chatelain, who's professor of history and African-American studies at Georgetown University. And just as a side note, Dana Roberson is pretty much a legend here at The Takeaway. She's an alum of the show, and there is no one who can say enough good things about her work. So I started by asking her why the anniversary of the Capitol riot was a good time to explore the history of democracy in this country.
Any time is a valuable time to unpack the history of democracy. And I tend to think if we had been doing it more regularly throughout the decades, perhaps we wouldn't be where we are a year from the events of last year. Through this documentary, we do reflect on the history, both globally and nationally. And you can tell by watching that this is a recurring theme that's happened over the centuries. There's been progress, and there's always been backlash to that progress. And I think each time there's been improvement along the way, but it might just take a little bit longer to continue to improve before you have that next backlash.
So, Dr. Chatelain, I want to come to you on that sort of description of American history that we get there from Dana, this idea of sort of the moving forward, the doubling back. Help us to think about how we think about both progress, change over time, but also those echoes from our history.
Well, I think this is one of the hardest things as an educator and as a historian to explain to the public. And, you know, people like Blair Kelly and Nell Painter and others are always reminding us that, yes, this may have the resonance, but the level of efficiency, the level of strategy in this moment of backlash may be stronger, it may be louder, it may be more violent, it may be less violent than the last time that happened. And I think that this is why this documentary is so important, so that we can see the strands. You know, one of the things I often say is that people talk about fake news and misinformation as being the product of the social media age. But if you look in the 1960s, there was lots of fake news about the civil rights movement. There was a lot of fake news about the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. But what we have now in the algorithms is the opportunity for people to form communities faster because of the big lies that they're believing in. And so I think that the thing that we're trying to always remind people is watch out for the strands. If it starts to feel familiar, this is a moment where you really need to pay attention.
You did talk to one of the only two Republicans on the House committee that's investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol. What did you learn in that particular conversation? And were you surprised by any of it?
I was surprised at, you know, it was Adam Kinzinger and Margaret Hoover, who's also in this documentary, did the interview with him. And he walked her through that day. He was in his chamber and he walked her through how, you know, he was fearful and he was ready to defend himself. And he had happened to bring his firearm into work with him that day and mentions that he was prepared to use it. And I was surprised by that. You know, I think a lot of people really sort of have this false equivalency that it's one side versus the other. So it's Republicans versus the Democrats. But everyone was fearful of their lives that day. And that's where there was common ground in the uncertainty of knowing what was going to happen. So I was surprised, pleasantly surprised, to maybe understand that for at least a period of time, there was some commonality and sentiment mm-hmm. that was mutual across the aisle. People were afraid and they wanted to survive and they were not happy with what was happening.
Professor Chatelain, as we're thinking about sort of that moment, January 6th, and typically sort of our conversations about it go only as far back as the 4 years of the Trump presidency. Can you walk us through kind of a longer landscape and maybe go back just by one presidency to the Obama presidency and the ways that the responses to the two terms of an Obama presidency also helped to lay the groundwork for this?
Because the years 2016 to 2020 felt like a million years, it's hard to remember sometimes that the rhetoric that immediately greeted President Obama was one about him not belonging to the state as a foreigner, that he had been engaged in all sorts of deceit, There was an obsession with his wife. There was all sorts of kind of vile caricatures of the president and the first lady. It wasn't just kind of regular political infighting, but it created the lexicon for the explicit and the veiled racist attacks on the president. It diminished, in the eyes of a certain segment of the population, the presidency at all. So you can go from this cherished institution that had been preserved by whiteness, a black person gets it, and now all hell breaks loose. And so in many ways, I think it's akin to the story that Isabel Wilkerson tells in The Warmth of Other Suns, where she says, you know, black people would go up north for greater social freedoms. They drink a drink in a bar and someone breaks the glass in front of them. And I think that what Trump did and what his supporters did and what happened on January 6th is they broke the glass in front of all of us and say, we will preserve this until we think that it has been sullied. And then the nihilism and the deep desire to destroy kicks in.
I am an unreconstructed optimist in the American project. I try not to be, but I grew up in Charlottesville, Virginia, and I could see Monticello from my window. Like, I can't help it. So I have to finish this interview by asking both of you, and Professor Chatelain, I'll start with you. If there is a strand of hope, if there is an aspect of optimism that we can hold on to,
for me, as someone who lives in Washington, D.C., has taught so many students who want to go into public service, I think that this moment is eye-opening and transformative, but I don't think it broke them, because we know the importance of people standing up to this type of thing. And I think we still have a lot of fight in us. And so I think there's a lot of reasons to be hopeful.
I agree with everything that Marcia just said. And I also, you know, I'm an optimist. You know, I try to be despite adversity, and it's worked for me so far. So I tend to believe that we can still be optimistic. It's going to be difficult. This is one of those ebbs and flows that happens. You know, it has over time and time again, and this country has survived. You know, I believe in this country. I think everyone that lives here believes in this country, at least I hope so. And I think we're survivors and we'll get through it. It's just going to take a lot of hard work.
Dana Roberson is the executive producer of Preserving Democracy, Pursuing a More Perfect Union. And Dr. Marcia Chatelain is the professor of history and African-American studies at Georgetown University. Dr. Chatelain, Dana, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
Now, if you made a Venn diagram of The Takeaway, you'd find my next guest at the intersection of multiple overlapping circles. This award-winning multi-platform journalist has served at our sister station, KQED, at Mother Jones, where we find great stories and guests, and she spent time at the Center for Investigative Reporting. And you know we talk to them on The Reg.
My name is Julia B. Chan. I'm the incoming editor-in-chief of The 19th. That is also the first time I've said my new title out loud to somebody, so thanks for that.
And as next editor-in-chief of The 19th News, Julia remains right here in The Takeaway Venn diagram. You know The 19th. They're the independent nonprofit newsroom reporting at the intersection of gender, politics, and policy. So, with somebody that connected to us, we knew that you would want to know more about her. So that's why we sat down to talk with Julia B. Chan. I asked her to tell me a little bit about herself and about her pathway to The 19th News.
I am very excited to have my first interview with you here, which will be carried on KQED, which is a wonderful way that my two pathways can connect so soon in really starting out this new journey with The 19th. So I started off at the San Francisco Examiner here in lovely San Francisco, California, really as someone who came in as a web producer who very much was just starting to learn journalism and learn media, and was that, you know, young person who knew the internet in the newsroom and introduced the newspaper to social media and to ideas around how things online could be done a little differently from print. So I really cut my teeth at the Examiner. From there, I went on to the Center for Investigative Reporting, which was a really great way to learn what more enterprise investigative journalism could be across platforms. And it really kind of took my nose off of that daily grindstone of daily news to be able to think about what long form was really like, and spent 5 years there and helped to launch Reveal, which is an investigative podcast. From there, I went on to Mother Jones to be their director of audience. And being the director of audience at Mother Jones, the first of its kind there, I was really able to experiment with the ways in which we talked and engage with our audience and what it really means to not just broadcast. When we think about engagement, I think even social media, a lot of media companies tend to take social and use it as yet another broadcast mechanism, you know, watch our thing, read our story, versus really opening it up into a two-way street. And my 2 years there really helped to set me up for this managing editor role that I was most recently at KQED, in which, as I'm sure you and the Takeaway audiences are familiar, public media has really been wanting to find ways to better engage audiences, not just the ones it has, but ones in which it purports to serve. And so really kind of bringing in engagement strategies to reach underserved and historically underserved communities here in the Bay Area was very much what I centered a lot of my mission around. And ultimately, all of that work really, I feel, culminates into this new role that I'll be taking on with the 19th, in which this brand new organization, journalism organization, is taking on policy and political journalism in a way that not only wants to speak to a nationwide audience, a national audience, but also wants to drill down into building communities with folks who have been historically underserved by the media at whole.
So what I love, you know, I ask you a relatively straightforward or simple question, but your level of enthusiasm, right, about this gig, about this role that that U.S. media and journalism and narrative storytelling and investigation and accountability, the idea that it still has something that can make you excited. So I want to see if I can ding that armor of sort of journalistic joy and ask, isn't journalism dying in this country? What is there to be this enthusiastic about?
Oh, that's a big question. And I'm with you there. And you know, this level of enthusiasm and joy, it definitely is not steady. You know, there are highs and lows to this work. But I think that is another reason that keeps me going. I do see a number of things, and I've experienced a number of stories and projects and movement that have continued to inspire and encourage me. And the ways in which communities of journalists have come together and have continue to speak out and create meaningful change and want to work at creating more meaningful change, like a burgeoning newsroom culture at the 19th, that is what's gotten me so excited. That's what's kind of keeping my fires lit, and seeing the ways in which the 19th wants to do things different, wants to take, not ignore the history, the legacy of the ways in which things are done, but, you know, kind of cherry pick, if you will, take the good parts of the culture and also do away with the bad parts of it. Really name what's worked and what hasn't worked, who it's served, who it hasn't served, who we center and who we don't. And being able to be in this place right now and feeling like we can have more frank conversations about not just the craft of journalism, but who we're making it for. I think that's what keeps me going. That's where, like, the inspiration for me lives. That's where the creativity lives. And, you know, as far as journalism dying, I mean, there's ways in which that absolutely is bearing out. The ways in which, you know, the business model is yet to be totally, you know, decided and agreed upon. But I think at this point, we all have seen more kind of diverse revenue business models shape up in ways that are supporting news organizations like the 19th or the New York Times or the Washington Post. I mean, I think as journalists, we tend to kind of clock each other a little bit, especially when it comes to like, hey, how are you surviving out here? And so it is interesting to see that. But in this age of misinformation and disinformation, yes, arguably, there are those dark days where you're like, why am I even doing this? And it's really those glimmers of light in seeing the impact of journalism still resonate and hearing directly from the audiences about the impact your organization's story had on their lives or on local legislation. That is definitely what keeps me going.
I want to hear a little more about that. I'm so fascinated. I feel like somewhere our own digital editor, Zach Bynum, who's, you know, a young, you know, 20-year-old something member of the team, always has 10,000 ideas in every pitch meeting, is going to hear you and be like, yes, all right, this is a trajectory where I can start in the digital space, but also, you know, thinking about sort of all of the other possibilities in the big career. And so talk to me a little bit, though, about that particular insight, which you've now said twice about the two-way communication, right? Where we're not just talking into the mic or into the camera or typing away on the laptop, but actually finding ourselves in some kind of dialogue with our audience.
Sure. It's so important the ways in which organizations should want to aim to engage with their audiences in a deeper way. I think, you know, historically, when we think about engagement, when we think about the ways in which our stories have reach, it's exactly that. It's reach. We want as many eyeballs as possible, or eardrums, or clicks, page views. And while reach, I think, has its own value and is a signal from audiences to your organization about, you know, what it's reading or listening to and the volume in which it's doing that, I think what organizations really are strategizing for now and are starting to prioritize now is that depth, that relationship with audiences in order to create trust.
Now, you actually serve on the board of the Asian American Journalist Association. And when you're talking about serving folks and being in conversation, also talk to me a bit about diversity in newsrooms. I almost hate to phrase it that way because it's a phrase that I think for so many of us has, you know, come to just represent like bean counting, right? Like how many people or how many voices, but meaningful engagement with diverse ideas and life experiences and persons.
Mm-hmm. It's so, so important for newsrooms to have a variety of perspectives at hand in its arsenal, however you want to think about what your newsroom looks like and the brains you have in the room. The more diverse and the variety of perspectives you can possibly have in that room on your team, I think is crucially important. Serving on AAJA, I mean, one of the unfortunately topmost examples that really comes up for me when I think about what it means to have a variety of perspectives in a newsroom, I think about last year's Atlanta shootings. And I think about how a number of journalists really came to the board sharing the situation in which they were not being assigned or considered in the coverage of the Atlanta shooting. And these are people with the expertise, with the language skills, with the cultural competency, and the access to the communities most impacted by this event. And yet their journalistic ethics and their angles were being questioned. Their bias was being questioned. And so, you know, being on the board and thinking about the ways in which that plays out, I don't think that is something that has historically played out across newsrooms that, you know, are majority white. I don't think people are out here questioning folks about their bias and whether or not they can give a solid story and provide a solid framing on an event. And so to really see this play out was another opportunity to kind of address the issue at hand and really, as AAJA, come out and say that, hey, these are journalists in your newsrooms that have access, that can provide the accurate and thorough reporting that you're looking for, and you should be leveraging them if they want these stories, because we also don't want tokenism in our newsrooms either. So, you know, that to me is like one example in which the, you know, having a variety of perspectives and experiences in a newsroom will better serve the reporting, because ultimately what we want to strive for, and this is something I'm very much prioritized going into the 19th, is nuance and context, quite frankly, leaning into specificity and cutting into broad strokes, because that's where I feel established narratives live. And that's how we can continue to complicate those established narratives, is really utilizing the identities and the intersectionality of identities in newsrooms and leveraging people's lived experience in order to better contextualize the journalism.
So I feel like I know what you mean when you say that, but I want to put that down where the goats can get it and help a listener to understand, someone who, in fact, you know, maybe spends their life doing something other than listening to the news or reading the news all day. What does it mean to go to a level that is deeper and actually challenging some of the broad strokes by investing in our newsrooms in those sort of contextual capacities that a journalist has, even at the same time that a journalist has got to, you know, have the sources and verify and all of those kinds of things?
I love that you're asking me to dig in deeper into this, because it's helping me find the words to better kind of articulate the ways in which I've seen this be executed well and the ways in which I think we could be doing better as an industry sometimes. So I think, you know, when I think about leveraging journalists or reporters in newsrooms who have access and skills that everyone may not have, I think about how they can navigate the communities most impacted by an event or the communities at the center of a story in order to best represent those perspectives. Because ultimately, as storytellers, what we want to be doing is helping to tell our community stories, and really hearing from them, having that access, having that trust, having built those relationships with the community and with those audiences, we can hear directly from folks, not only just about what happened and what the story at hand is, but be able to ask them to contextualize their story and their perspective by telling us how they identify or what may have inspired or informed their reaction or their response to what just happened, to really just dig in deeper and tell a deeper story as to why something is happening, why it's impacting the community, and how. And, you know, really leaning into that specificity means, you know, sharing those details. It means fact-checking those details, means following lead after lead after lead, and really not just with the goal of producing stellar journalism, but also with the goal of continuing to deepen that relationship with that community. Because the kind of storytelling I very much value on a personal level is one that is committed, one that stays with a community or a topic and communicates with an audience about whether or not the story has a beginning and an end, and how long we're committed to following it. I think as media organizations, we don't do the best job of that. I think sometimes, you know, we've been accused of parachuting in, definitely, and the ways we can get, you know, really not perpetrate that and not do that is to work with community groups on the ground, nonprofits, local organizations. And so there's ways in which I think we could do it better. But even beyond that, I think we could do a better job of telling folks when we are following a story and when we may be closing out. Maybe, you know, we are following something up until an election. We're going to share what the election results are. And then that is the end cap of this project for us for A, B, and C reasons. I think as a media organization, I know that's something I'm very much interested in continuing to do in order to, again, really invest in that relationship with the audience and be as transparent as possible with them about what we're doing, why, and for how long.
Thanks to Julia B. Chan, incoming editor-in-chief of the 19th News, for joining us today. That's the politics that we have for you today, folks. We hope you enjoyed it. And if you missed anything or you just want to listen back, check out our podcast. It's available wherever you get your audio. Or head on over to thetakeaway.org. Now, before I take off, I want to send a huge shout out to the team who makes this show every single week with me. Our senior producer is Ethan Oberman. Shanta Covington is our planning editor. Our producers are Meg Dalton, Katarina Barton, Deborah Goldstein, and Joseph Jedian. And thank you to Max Balton, who produced some of the great pieces for us over the holiday season. Zachary Bynum is our digital editor. Vince Fairchild is our broadcast engineer. Jay Coward is our director. And both Vince and Jay do that beautiful sound design. Shyam Sundra and Milton Ruiz helped us out on the board in the last few weeks as well. Jackie Martin is our line producer. David Gable is our administrative assistant. And Mary Croak is our executive producer. Thanks so much for listening. Me, I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.